Wednesday, January 3rd, 2024, new year. Here we are, brought to you by Tech GC.
Tech GC.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year from Tech GC.
Tech GC. Happy New Year.
All right.
How was your New Year's Eve, man?
It was great, man. The kids stayed up till midnight for the first time. They made a deal. There was like all sorts of negotiating and managing, and it was like, can we stay up? Can we stay up? We'll do all of our preparation for the school day a day in advance. And it was like, they were, you remember the feeling when you first see New Year's? I don't like, it's lost on me because I've done it 45 times, but like, it's awesome to watch that again. They were blown away.
That's cool, man. Well, that sounds like a lot
of fun. It was great. It was great. We had family activities.
Cool. Well, I spent mine in my living room watching like Nashville New Year's Eve on TV. I had COVID again. But it was fine. You know, honestly, man, I like a good quiet New Year's. It was cool. I ate my 12 grapes. I drank a little champagne and played Mario Kart all day. That was literally what happened on New Year's Eve.
What's the 12 grapes? Is that a thing you do every year?
Oh, I think it originates as a Spanish tradition, but it's very much a Cuban and Latin American tradition across many countries, which is to, in addition to your champagne at midnight, eat 12 grapes for good luck for the next year. So I chugged my 12 grapes. I drank my little champagne and, went back to Mario Kart.
One of the gifts from Santa this year in our house was a Switch, and that has Mario Kart.
I'm obsessed with my Switch, man.
So Mario Kart and a game called Animal Crossing, pretty big in our house, right?
Yeah, I know Animal. Yeah. I don't play Animal Crossing, but it's very popular with the youths.
Very popular.
I love Mario Kart. If you guys subscribe to Nintendo Online or whatever, then we need to play against each other. And let me tell you, I'm not giving your kids any wins, man. I'm going to annihilate them every time. Uncle Pedro is going to be hard on them so that 10 years from now, when they defeat me for the first time, they feel pride.
They're hitting Animal Crossing pretty hard right now, so I have to see how to get them into Mario. But speaking of popular, Cynthia Cole, partner at Baker McKenzie. I met her at IAPP through our good friend Stephanie King, who knows her from I think being a GC in the Bay Area. And dude, we had a lot written down to talk to her about, and we covered almost nothing that we wrote down, and it was a great
awesome
conversation.
Yeah, what
she's,
a good chat.
Had a really interesting career.
Yeah, she's a very interesting person. Yeah. And like, I love her career trajectory. From the conversation, people will see, I was like really interested in her transition from in-house back to law firms and how that played out, which, you know, hasn't always been an interesting proposition for me, but I'm starting to see the light on like how cool it could be. And she's the example, the emblem of like how to do it well, and how to do it really successfully and how to be very discerning about where, you know, I think Baker McKenzie is the right firm for her. You can tell just by how she talks about it. I think she feels like she made the right decision, that she's well supported, and like everybody wins there. Clients win, the firm wins, she wins, everybody wins.
It seems like a good environment. She's got this really cool ability to have a mixed practice, which is very rare. Like, she does privacy, cyber, tech transactions. She's obviously like looped into AI now. So speaks to the flexibility of a big machine, which is not common.
Yeah. Speaking of big machines, we often critique law firms and the law firm culture around here. But I have a cool Baker McKenzie anecdote. 750 years ago, when I first started getting into data privacy, so like 2010, maybe 2009, whenever that was that I started getting interested, I went to some sort of speaking engagement. I wasn't a speaker. I just went as a guy. I can't remember what it was. Some panel of something, maybe HIPAA, some shit like that. And one of the speakers was a Baker McKenzie partner, and I do not remember his name. I can see him, but I don't remember his name. And he did his thing, and he was fine. But as part of his participation, Baker McKenzie had the little booklets. Do you remember these things? The Baker McKenzie, I don't remember what they were called, but they were this annual like summary of privacy rules around the world. Do you remember this?
I don't
Baker
think
McKenzie
so.
Used to release these things. I remember this book. I might actually have one in here. And I remember getting like the 2009 or 2010 copy or whatever year this was. And it was this little booklet. By the time I was full-fledged in practice, 2015, that booklet was like three times the size of the original one that I'd gotten. And I don't know if Baker McKenzie still has that booklet or now it's online or whatever, but that was one of the most valuable resources I had in the early days, which was essentially like a summary of like legislation and rulemaking around the world related to data privacy and data protection. What a great resource that was at the beginning of my career. And it
was
free.
Awesome. I mean, I get this question a lot, like from people that want to learn and they need sort of like, where can I find stuff like that? And it's not that common to find stuff like that. Like DLA's website is really good for this specific kind of thing, as well as
and Mofo has some good stuff too.
Yeah, Mofo and the Trade Desk, if you're into ad tech, has all these like primer videos. Sure. Like at some point we should do kind of something where we talk about all of the resources. We should maybe like get a group to talk about the resources that are available online, because there's a lot. Now it's online, obviously not a book, but I love when firms do stuff like that. Put it out there.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah,
me too. Anyway, shout out to Baker.
Shout out to Baker. Shout out to Cynthia. I think people are going to like this one.
Hey, friends. It's me, Chris, with TechGC. Wanted to let you know that if you're currently in-house counsel, need to wrap up all those CLE credits before the January 31st deadline, TechGC On-Demand CLE is now available for all 50 states. If you're not a TechGC member yet, request an invite at techgc.co, mention on-demand CLE, and we'll fast-track your request. Fulfill your CLE requirements with the most dynamic GCs in technology. Go to techgc.co, request an invite. Now back to the show.
Last off. Here we are.
We're here.
Oh, shoot.
Cynthia Cole is our guest, partner at Baker McKenzie. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Good.
Thank you for having me. I am so excited.
Well, hey Pedro, you didn't know this, but Cynthia and I were emailing, and she said she listened to a lot of our old episodes too.
I'm sorry to hear that.
Nobody ever says that to us, by the way.
They're not good. Our guests really? Are fantastic.
No, yeah, the guests are great.
The guests are fantastic, but like, well, I guess what I mean is like, we didn't have fancy equipment. Like, the audio was crappy, the video was crappy, but like, you know. I had the best time in the early days because it was just wild. We were just doing whatever.
Yeah, it was really fun.
Yeah. I think the content is great, right? I mean, and of course I'm here, and what else would I say? And you know, would I say something different? I might, though. If you know me well enough, you know I might.
I can't even tell you your podcast sucks.
No. Welcome.
I would. What a fun debate that would be.
I'm here for it. Not at all. Not at all. No, I mean, I love the points that I just, I've actually enjoyed listening to, you know, a fair number of them over the last couple weeks.
We appreciate you as a listener and even more so as a guest. I will say that like Andy and I are very intentional about like keeping this lighthearted and sort of like not, you know, we don't want to make we don't want to create the podcast treatise on data protection or tech law or ad tech or any of these things. We just want to like highlight influential, interesting people and talk a little shit and hang out and then share it with the world. That's the goal here. And, you know, while we do that, flush out some cool ideas and some issues. Sure. Whatever.
Yeah.
I'm totally on board for that. I feel like that's my, so my daughter, when we were with my family over the break, right, over the holidays, and we were talking about, you know, what do we want to do in 2024? And I said, I took my kids ocean kayaking this year, in 2023 nice. For the first time, right? Because you can go in the Monterey Bay, and it was something I'd always wanted to do. So I said, you know, I'd really like to figure out a way that I could do that more, right? I'd like to like get a kayak or like do it more. And my daughter, who's 18, looks at my parents and she goes, oh yeah, my mom's motto is YOLO.
Oh boy.
And I said, okay, what are you? And she said, you only live once. She said, Mom, I have never ever heard you say no to anything. Like, you're just, and I said, oh, you're right. I think that is my motto. So
well, good for
that's
you.
A really good place to
know,
start.
You know, it's also, in addition to a motto, it's also a factual statement. As far as I know, I mean, I don't know, maybe there's reincarnation and I'll come back as a cockroach. But like, as far as I know, we only got this one run at this thing. So it's a good motto. It's also probably true.
Yes. Well, agreed. Right. Agreed. And I guess, you know, if you look at my career, you might, you know, you might say the same thing, right? I mean, it's true that I'm willing to, I very rarely say no. And yeah. sometimes that's to my detriment.
Yeah.
And it's a big fail. But occasionally it works out.
Tell me about the art of saying yes. What is, how do you think about that? Or is it just an impulse reflex? Like, are you methodical about this? Like, how do you decide yes? Even if you decide mostly yes, how do you get to yes?
Oh, man. I would say, well, for me, truly, yes is much easier than no, right? Mm-hmm. And that is something I've tried to work on because I feel like I need to set better boundaries. Mm-hmm. But I'm curious, right? I want to learn all the time. So if someone comes to me and says, hey, do you want to participate in this? Or do you want to help in this? Or I mean, to me, it's like, if it looks interesting, if it looks like I could learn something, or it looks like somewhere, I think, especially now in my career, where I could add value, right? I could involve other people who I know, you know, want a platform, or do you know what I mean? Like if it's a presenting or speaking or doing something, and I can involve people and give other people a voice who maybe don't have it or are kind of looking for it. Or I don't know. There are just so many things for me that are a very quick yes, right?
Does that come from you spent time in-house in companies as well as in private practice now? Do you think that comes from having done that, or did that come before? Like, did you just sort of, you were wired that way before you did that?
So I think I'm wired that way partially, right? And then I also think that being in house, I think to succeed in house, you have to say yes more than you say no. Right. Mm-hmm. I mean, especially as a general counsel, if your CEO is asking you to dive in and tackle issues or do things and you're saying no, you're probably not going to have that job for very long.
Yeah. 8 minutes.
Right. So. Right.
Yeah.
So I think that, yeah, you learn. And that is true. Actually, that has been that's been interesting in sort of going back in a private practice is that I feel like, you know, I'll be in a room with a bunch of other outside counsel. Right. And they are saying, that looks tricky. Ooh, you know, maybe that's a little too. And I'm like, yes, yes, let's do it. Let's do it. Right. So,
what do you think? Are you driven to? Oh, go ahead, Pedro. Sorry.
Yeah, yeah. I was gonna say, like, so you made the transition from in-house to outside counsel, which is an interesting transition that I'm seeing more often now than I used to. But it's not a very common transition. How did you go into making that decision? What lured you back, or like, tell us about just choosing to go back to or go to a law firm?
Yeah. So So when I, you know, when I was in law school and graduated from law school, my first position in a law firm as corporate, did corporate securities M&A work. And I really didn't like it very much. I'll be totally honest. I didn't like being in that particular firm, and I didn't really find people who I admired or I thought were frankly very interesting. Many of the associates I worked with, yes, right. And I'm still good friends with them. And But I didn't feel like that was my place. And I really always wanted to be general counsel. I kind of had two goals when I graduated from law school. One was to be a general counsel and the other was to work internationally. And so I'd sort of chose opportunities when I was able to choose. Sometimes you only have one choice. Kind of geared around those goals, right? And so I ended up, you know, I was in France and I came back to Silicon Valley and I was general counsel for three different companies. And then my last position, I was interim CEO because in May 2016, the CEO of the company where I was working then, Spectre 7 Microsystems, passed away suddenly of a heart attack. And I became interim CEO. And so I ran the company. I was general counsel at the same time, but I ran the company for a little less than 6 months, right?
So just quickly, what led that company to choose the GC for that, which is not something you hear it occasionally, but you don't hear that so frequently. Like, what about that situation made you the stable keeping person, you know, in that kind of scenario?
So I had been hired, not a very big company. We're publicly traded, still are on the Toronto Stock Exchange. But I had been chosen by the CEO basically to be his sort of right hand person, right, in strategy and, you know, legal, but strategy, partnerships, and so. I made sense as the person to sort of continue that because he and I, you know, we worked very closely together. I was learning. I learned a lot from him in kind of a short amount of time. He was a really dynamic leader. And so, yeah, I think it was the right choice.
CEO, you want to add that? That's something I don't think I ever want to be, just to put that out there. I don't know. It seems intense.
You know, it is. So here's the thing. And it is intense, right? It's a lot of pressure because you feel pressure in a different way than you do as a general counsel, because you feel you're the one who is setting strategy, right, for the company. And you are thinking about risk in a very different way, right? You take it into account, but if you're not leading with what's the right opportunity, right? If you're leading with the risk, then you're not going to go anywhere, right? I felt much more poignantly the responsibility for the employees and the business plan. And, you know, if this fails, if we have consecutive bad quarters, then these people are going to lose their jobs, right? Like, it's a different sort of pressure that you don't feel. But you also, because you're CEO, you get a lot more leeway, right? You get more opportunities to, first of all, you can be less tactful, right? As a general counsel, I feel like I'm always trying to be tactful, you know, right? And as a CEO, you can frankly be pretty bullish and obnoxious. Not like I am, but we have seen a few, I'm sure, right?
I've never seen a CEO ever act obnoxious or recalcitrant or demanding. I've never seen that. They're all pretty understanding, compromise-oriented people.
Yeah.
Right. That's exactly my point. Exactly,
you know what's interesting
my
about
point.
That? What's interesting about that is I think the things that make you a good employee don't necessarily make you a good leader or especially CEO. Like, there's the, you know, I don't think personality is a requirement for a leadership position. I really don't. I don't. But I do think that I don't want to use the word ego, but like a little, like a confidence is something that CEOs do have to admit. Everybody should admit some confidence, but like it's part of the job there, I think to like,
it's like
establish
surgeons.
Confidence.
I think it's like surgeons, you know, same idea.
See, but I don't agree because like, for example, if I have to have brain surgery, I got to be honest, and maybe this is me being biased and crazy, but if I have a choice between Mr. Charisma, you know, like shows up in the Porsche after playing golf 18 holes and is going to, you know, whip out my skull and start dibbling dabbling, or like a bookwormy sort of introverted analytical person who only uses his hands to eat and do surgery, I'm probably going that direction.
I think you're well, it's interesting. You're drawing distinctions between two very different characters. And I think what I'm actually referring to in terms of confidence is something in the middle, which is like, and with a surgeon, I'm agree with you. I don't want some flashy, you know, who is zero substance. Right. But you definitely need somebody who is like, I'm going to go into your brain and I'm going to get this done. Like, yeah, that, no, of that, course. That can't stop. So, like,
yeah, I have a friend, of course, of course.
I have a friend who is literally a brain surgeon, and he's the best video game player I've ever come across. And that sounds stupid, but it actually speaks to, he's the smartest, one of the smartest people I've ever met, but he also has incredible hand-eye coordination. Like, I want those things. And he's,
that's
like,
the
very
surgeon I want, man.
Very confident in himself.
But like, so, you know, but the thing is, like, but the thing is that, like, social media, the movies, Hollywood, they sort of glorify the, like, yeah, maverick Tom Cruise type leader. But even in the movie itself, like the movies themselves, Tom Cruise is not the, like, source of authority or the source of calm and decisiveness in the story itself. Like, the, if you watch the second Top Gun movie, like, what's his nemesis turned friend's name? Why am I drawing a blank?
Iceman.
Iceman, oh my goodness.
Yeah.
Shout out to Iceman. Iceman turns out to be the admiral and the confident leader of sailors and pilots, not Maverick, who ends up in a warehouse somewhere, you know, doing whatever that was until they called him for this one thing. So, like, I think the movies, like, school, media sort of glorifies these, like, big personality types. But reality is, I don't see them as effective as, like, operators a lot of the time. Like, Tim Cook, critique him all you want, he's turned that company into the second wealthiest company in the history of Earth, right? The second most valuable company in the history of Earth, behind, like, I don't know, Indian Trading Company. Like, he's in that level of, you know, Steve Jobs didn't take that company there. He did.
Well, Cynthia, when you took on the role of CEO, did you feel you needed to change? Did you feel you needed to do things differently, or did that just come, like, naturally with doing the job and sort of feeling it out differently?
So that's a good question. So the evening when we found out, right, that the CEO had passed away, we had an emergency board meeting. And again, we were publicly traded. So we had this board meeting after the close of the trading. And the board at the time wanted to make an announcement, like, at the open, right? The market open the next day. And most of the employees across the world, but most of the employees in California, we were in California, but obviously Toronto is 3 hours ahead, right? So they wanted to make the announcement at 6 a.m. the next morning at, you know, market, 6 a.m. Pacific time, yep, market open. And many of the employees, this was one of the characteristics that I really appreciated about Tony, was most of the employees had been handpicked, right, by Tony. And he knew them all personally. A lot of them had come with him through different, you know, sort of cycles of companies and different. And so they said, okay, well, this is what we're going to do. We have to do this because we can't trade. You know, clearly, no, we can't have, right, we can't have people trading on, that people need to know.
Yeah.
And I said, we can't do that. And they all looked at me and they said, what are you talking about? And I said, well, we can't do that because we can't put out an announcement to the market and not tell the team. They can't be asleep. Like, the employees can't be asleep. They have to know at the same time that everyone else knows. Like, these people know Tony. They're going to be profoundly affected by this. Yeah. And we can't do this. Yeah. And they said, well, you know, so our outside counsel at the time said, okay, look, we can do it this way. We can stop trading, right? And we can make an announcement at 9 a.m. Pacific time. We just stop trading in the morning and people will wonder what's going on, but we'll make sure that then we make a simultaneous announcement at 9 a.m. And I said, and the board was still kind of hemming and hawing, right? And I said, look, you just made me CEO, right? So I'm going to make this decision. Because I know that this is what Tony would do. Yeah. I know this is what Tony would do. And so, and that's what we did, right? And so, to answer your question, Andy, I definitely did have to, I don't know that I changed. I think I did have to lean in to, you know, parts of my personality that were, let's say, maybe underdeveloped. Right. Or that I didn't feel like I had the ability or the right, maybe, or the right to, or the opportunity to actually use.
This goes, wow. Andy, like Cynthia's actions in that crisis, because that's what that is, are emblematic of your point about confidence. That's the type of confidence I think you mean, which is, holy shit, this is a horrible situation. I'm getting feedback that is different than what I think we should do. I'm going to make the call. Of course you want that confidence, right? Yeah. Like, how profound, your leader. That makes a lot of sense. That's not the same thing as bravado, which is what I was sort of talking about, which is fucking bullshit.
I mean, they often come hand in hand, so you're not wrong.
That's right. They're intertwined sometimes.
To assume that that's part of it. But what a significant moment for you.
Yeah, what a way to become the leader.
To have to make that call, to lean in and make that call right at that moment. It's almost like I'm maybe answering my own question a little bit, but it's almost like, no, like you had to do that right away. You didn't necessarily have the luxury of 3 months of, you know, feeling out the job and figuring it out. No, you didn't have that.
Well, I'll tell you, like, having worked in an organization where those types of transitions, like the one you went through, happen often, in the military, often you become the leader through very similar situations. And there is an entire framework around like ensuring continuity, right? Because that's part of the deal of the organization. And when you assume command or leadership because of a crisis like the one you faced, I think, in my experience, decisiveness is one of the most important things you can do to instill confidence in those around you that you're going to lead them in a positive direction. So I think your decisiveness in that moment to follow your instincts and follow what your experience was telling you was the right thing based on your understanding of the situation probably instilled a lot of confidence in the people around you that while it sucks to lose your transformative, you know, leader that everyone has some powerful relationship with, they were in good hands. I think like sticking with the theme of confidence, instilling confidence in others is much more important than demonstrating your own. And I think your actions did both really well. So
there's a lot of that, Pedro, there's a lot of that in parenting.
I believe that.
I'm wondering, well, just a lot of what you just described in terms of like allowing your kids to feel that you have, that a parent has it under control, no matter what's going on, you know? And so it's Cynthia, you're a parent. I'm wondering like, that stuff play into your mind, you know, when you're both parenting and working, I'm sure.
Always. And then leading a team, right? And then, you know, it's the same. I think you asked about, and then why did I decide to go back into private practice, right? And I think I wasn't offered the job to be permanent CEO, which I was fine with. Yeah. But when they brought on a permanent CEO, I thought, I think I need to move on. Right. I don't want to stay here. And when I was looking at my options and sort of looking around and seeing what was available, if for the first time in my life, and honestly, truly my friends and family were like, do we need to stage an intervention? You're actually talking about going back into, private practice. And because they were like, you hated it. Why would you go back to practice? But I felt like it was a moment where if I could find the right platform, the right firm, right, the right opportunity where I could take my, 17 years of experience at the time, right, and make it into something that would create value, that would be interesting. And I thought, I thought I could do it. And I also thought I could fail miserably, right? It could be a horrible experiment for me. But I also thought, that's okay, right? What's the worst that happens? Like I failed before, or I've had, negative personal or professional experiences, and I pulled myself through it and I worked it out, right? With support. I mean, you never do those things all by yourself, but I felt like it was the right opportunity, the right time to take a risk and to go in and to build, to really, I feel like take charge of my career in a different way than I had been able to before.
And how that goes to your YOLO, you know, which I think is cool. How different, I mean, you're a leader at your firm, and I think you were also like the chair at your previous firm. How is leadership in the firm different than it was when you were in-house? Obviously, it's going to be different than CEO, but like even in-house as GC, like how is leading in the outside council environment different, more interesting, less interesting, whatever?
So, what I like about being back in a firm is that I have a lot. This is going to, I mean, I like it and I don't like it, right? I have a lot of other attorneys that I can work with as a team, right? A lot of people who I can bounce ideas off of. We can work together. We can knowledge share, right, on the same topics. Whereas when you're in-house, I felt like that was often lonely, you know, to be general counsel. And I was learning, you know, I loved being around the CEO, the CFO, CTO, the engineers. I loved being kind of the most ignorant person in the room, you know, on that particular topic. Like, so wait a minute, what are we doing with chips? What does that mean? Can you draw me a map? You know, I don't mind being in that position, right? I like learning in that way, but it's nice to be around people that are, who have similar experience that you can knowledge share and bounce ideas off of. And then same with kind of leveraging, you know, client work, being able to take something that you do for one client and then repurpose it for another one, because you know that those issues are going to come up for them. Right. And I guess you just kind of have the thing that I like too about leading in a firm is that it's a bigger team, I mean, than what I had, because I was general counsel of smaller companies. So I have more associates. I have a bigger kind of team. And then also I can make an impact in different ways, right? I have firm resources. I can help, you know, when I have clients who are looking for jobs or who are, you know, looking to transition or doing different things, I have access to information. I have access to people, right, that I didn't have access to when I was in-house. So I can use those resources and that platform in different ways. And to me, that's leadership, right? Leadership is taking what you have. I mean, I think it's perspective, first of all, and decision-making, but it's also taking a look around at like where you are and how can you use what you have, the tools, the team, the information, the influence, if you have it, how can you use it to sort of better other people's lives or make a difference for your clients in ways, obviously doing the work, you know, notwithstanding, but, you know, can you help them in their diversity initiatives by making sure that you're also promoting people on their team, right, to do different projects or to speak or to, I mean, do you know what, does that make sense? So,
yeah, that's perfect.
So I like having that platform. I like being able to lead in that way, which is more creative.
That doesn't really sound like a typical law firm scenario to me, though. Like, so you've been at Baker Botts and now Baker McKenzie, and you were with, you know, other firms before that. Maybe Baker Hostetler is next. You can hit all three Bakers.
Do all the Bakers, man.
I don't think so.
Yeah, no, okay. I know. But like that seems, when we've heard other friends and folks talk about going from private practice in-house and then back, they often talk about, often they're going in as partners because they've had, you know, multi-year situations, but then they're often going back and they're describing more of the scenarios that you mentioned, more different, more control over their own destiny, more control over the, team they can sort of put around them. And it makes the law firm a lot more, I don't want to use the word palatable, but like it makes the law firm a lot more of a, enjoyable and useful platform for them to do the things that potentially, like when they were in house, they got to do some of those things. And it's like you don't always expect that to be available in law firms necessarily because the environment is different.
I mean, I think it's pretty simple, Andy. Being an associate is not a fun experience. I've never heard anyone come in here and go, being an associate was the best time of my life. No one's ever said that in the 100 episodes we've had and the thousands of lawyers I've met. But being a partner has perks. And like the thing is, there's two ways to get there. Do the associate track and do that grind, and that's one grind, or do a different grind, which is go in house, go into regulatory work, go into enforcement, you know, spend a lot of time making less money and then come back around with your expertise that is enough to provide you with the opportunity to become a partner at a firm. And that experience can go much more positively. It doesn't always, but it can. I find the idea of returning to a law firm, I was at a law firm for a couple years after I left the government. I had a decent time. I mean, you're an associate. You got to bill hours. You got to do the things. But I worked for Dennis Ollie, a decent man, and I worked on a good team, and I had a good time. As best as you can as an associate. But I only did it for 3 years because it was wearing me down, right? Yeah. But it's very seductive to me, the idea of doing this in-house thing for a while longer. And then once I've accumulated a ton of skills, going and sharing those skills across lots of clients is really interesting to me. Right now I give all of my expertise and talent to one organization, and it's one that I care about, and I want to do the work as well as I can. But I don't know, Andy, maybe it doesn't appeal to you, but I think it has to be appealing to people who like work really hard at becoming really good at what they do to share that expertise with lots of willing recipients, which in our world means clients.
What appeals to me more than going to a large law firm, it doesn't appeal to me so much that I'm going to go do it. So put that out there. Yeah. But what appeals to me more is sort of the entrepreneurial start my own thing. A lot of the qualities that you mentioned, being able to have multiple clients.
Yeah, I think so.
And I think it's one of the reasons, Cynthia, you and I talked about this over that Baker McKenzie dinner, like, it's one of the things that I think makes your practice unique. You get to work with a bunch of smaller clients. Baker McKenzie allows you, shockingly, for a large firm, the freedom to work with startups and work as an outside GC. So you're kind of getting the experiences that I think we're talking about inside of a large platform. And I think the few firms that allow for that and make room for that are the ones that just have like greater take rate in terms of like, partner happiness, longevity, the things that maybe are less talked about in that world, maybe.
I think that's a good point. That's a really good point, Andy. And I didn't, it's hard to understand how law firms work, right? And which sounds,
you know, no, it is.
But I found it really hard. I mean, you know, when I was an associate, for sure, I was like, I don't get this. I don't understand the power dynamics. I don't understand, are we a team or aren't we a team? This doesn't really look like teamwork. And then it's hard to, firms do, like you said, Andy, firms do things differently. They have different types of clients. They have different sort of revenue models, the way that they, right? And the way they provide service, all of those things. And all of those, mainly the sort of client model, right, is what drives, just like you said, that's what drives the kind of opportunity inside those firms for partners and associates and the kind of work that you get and the kind of work that you can build, right? The kind of practice you can build. I couldn't do what I do at every firm.
Is that a business model thing or is that a people thing? And by that, I mean, I've told you guys this before, like I've used Baker McKenzie at multiple companies and I have not worked at large companies by and large. I've worked at a couple, but like at the smaller companies, a firm of that size has made itself still been able to make itself accessible to me. Whereas like I've gone to other firms, same size or smaller. And they're like, you need a retainer, $20,000. We can't do anything. Like that's just, What is that? Is that people? Is that business model? Like, what drives the differences, you think?
I think it's a, I mean, I think a lot of it is client, right? Some firms only, they only work, or they mainly work with banks, or they mainly work with, you know, on, or they're more litigation focused, or they're more corporate. I mean, you know, so, so there is that, but then there is also, then there's the infrastructure. There's the kind of infrastructure that they have to support, right? The kind of like overhead, right? Are they able to discount their rates, or do they have to maintain, you know, a super high rate all the time for everything that they do? Do they have scale? Can they leverage, right? Do they have the part, is it only partners that are doing the work, or do they have, you know, paralegals and junior associate, like, so it's a number of factors. And then I do think, you know, one of the things that I have benefited from, right, is that when I started practicing in 2000, one, privacy didn't exist, right? I mean, this kind of practice didn't exist that I, you know, that I do. And also, and this is, has been driven very much by clients, which I really appreciate, right? But by big companies and sort of diversity and difference and neurodiversity, like you guys have talked about on your podcast before, right? All of these things that have pushed firms to be more open to different ways of doing business and different ways of providing service. And I think some firms have been able to pivot in the right ways to address, right, those very real concerns that still exist, right? But those, but they have changed. There has been progress, and other firms haven't. And a lot of that is driven by the partnership, potentially, right? Because, big surprise, people who have a lot of power and money don't always want to give it up, you know?
Never heard that. That's a surprise.
It's like the confident CEO.
Gosh, never seen.
Listening to you guys talk about this, though, like, you know, Andy, we talk about, like, we criticize law firms all the time and all the things and the business model and all the stuff. And, you know, law firms are easy fodder for critique. We know that. They're also the, like, law firms are also, like, the scaffolding of our entire profession, just to be clear. Like, they do have a role to play that is a very important one in the ability for us to all operate, including people in-house. When I hear you react to, you know, the big firm versus small firm entrepreneurial sort of like trade-offs, what's interesting to me is, again, as a return, right? Like on the back end of my career or on the back third or whatever, right? Like, let's say I went back in 5 years, right? I'm almost 50 years old. I've been at this for 20 some odd years. Like, this is going to be the last thing I do, most likely. I actually would not want to hang a shingle and like spend time doing admin and, like, you know, we talked to Phil Lee, who I love and did hang his shingle and is doing a great job and running an amazing firm. But he talked himself about how he's his own accountant. He's his own back bookkeeper. He's all, you know, him and his brother work on all the back end stuff and spend a tremendous amount of time on that. I would not want to do that on the back end of my career. I would want to focus on the practice of law, and that's it. And that's something that a big organization like Baker and like large established law firms can offer me, which is all of the scaffolding around my practice, or I can focus on delivering the best service I can to clients without any of those distractions, or doing it while cutting other parts of my life out to fill in all of the administrative things that I'm going to have to do to keep my small firm alive. What's your reaction to that, Andy? And like, Cynthia, I'm interested if that made a decision in how you went back to private practice of going big firm versus small firm, which is like the administrative burden.
I think it makes Cynthia's choice of firm, you know, clear in terms of how you're operating and thinking about your choice. But in terms of how I would pursue doing it personally, I tend to actually kind of agree with you, Pedro. I don't want to do that much admin either. But I think, so I wouldn't do it alone. I don't think I would be the type of person to go do that on my own. I think I would, I'm a team guy.
I couldn't do it.
So if I were going to do something, yeah, I would do it with two or three people. I wouldn't do it by myself. But that presupposes that somebody is responsible for some of those admin things, or we're splitting it up, right? So that it's not 100%.
Yeah.
So that's one thing is I tend to agree with you. I wouldn't roll solo. I think that's really hard, and it takes you know, a filly who is oversubscribed from day one can get off the ground pretty quickly, and he probably doesn't have to do as much as he used to. But I think to where Cynthia has gone, I think it would be like, it would speak to, where can I go where I can still do the kind of work that I like to do for clients. When you've been in house, it's like a very different, it can be, as we all know, a very different practice where you're, you know, acting as an outside GC the way you can sometimes, Cynthia, acting between tech trans, corporate IP and privacy cyber. Like, that's very uncommon. Like, you don't see, people are so specialized, right? So I think, like, Pedro, it depends on the person, right? Like, you know, you may love kind of doing three or four things that fit within that you're really good at. Someone might, or someone might like to do that and to do something different. But I think what you have, Cynthia, that's so unique is like they're buttressing your ability to kind of still be the GC in a lot of ways, which is like very, very rarely seen, especially with the scaffolding, Pedro, that you mentioned. It's a rarity, which is why you won't go to the third baker. Like, it makes sense.
Yeah, no, and it's true. And I didn't, you know, these are not things that I planned out. Like, I'm a planner, you know, I make lists and I think about, you know, in 5 years, I'd kind of like to do this, but I don't consider myself to be necessarily strategic, right? I just have like things that I would like to do. And when I went back into private practice, everything that you just said, Andy, I don't think I had fully enunciated. I hadn't thought of all of that necessarily, right? Or maybe I did, but wasn't on the forefront, right? And I think that, but you're absolutely right. And so, but those are the things that, again, like to get back to Pedro's question about how do you get to yes? I operate by instinct a lot. And again, sometimes it's not the best, right? I've been known to make bad choices or to, right? And it doesn't always work
good
out
for you. yeah, that means you're taking risks. That's okay.
But I do, I go with, you know, I think that this feels right. I think this, you know, I think this could work, and let me see how I can. And I'm flexible enough, I would say, in the way also that I hate to use the word operate because I'm not an operator, but right, in the way that I do things or the way that I create, I have a certain amount of flexibility. And so I'm able to kind of use that flexibility, I think, to my benefit, right? And also think to my clients' benefit as well. But I think that, yes, those are the things that being able to, at this point in my career, I'm going to be 53 in February, which is like amazing to me, that, you know, I became a partner at 50, like a woman for the first time, you know, I became a partner as a 50-year-old woman, right, in a practice that didn't exist when I started practicing law, right? So that felt pretty amazing to me that like on the back end of my, like Pedro said, like the back third.
Back third, right? Back third. Yeah, we're still young out here. We're still young out here.
Right. That's right. We're still young. We're still young. But we are definitely, you know, on the, let's say, the more mature side of our career.
We're forgetting more than we're learning probably at this point. It's fine. It's okay. It's okay.
It's okay. That's all right. There's a lot of absorbing that's still happening.
Yes.
But that, that's amazing to me. Like, I really feel, yes, am I exhausted? Do I work too much? Do I try to do too much? Absolutely. But am I happy professionally for like the first time or in a way that is new and different to me? Right. Absolutely.
That's cool.
And that's amazing to me. Yeah, like, I'm like, cool. I'm really thankful, right? Like, I really am truly that I can do this where I do it and that it's in demand, and I like it.
That's awesome.
Yeah, I love that. Going back to like the associate versus partner thing, like when I look at myself as an associate, the only thing I really had to offer was baseline knowledge and my time. That's all I had to offer. I didn't have anything else to offer. That's valuable. Okay. That's really valuable, especially to a law firm. But it's not like, for me, it's not the kind of value I'm interested in. This value that you're talking about, which is now you come around, you have all of this expertise and experience to see through the noise and get to the heart of things, is not only great for clients, but it allows you to focus on the things that are really important, which you couldn't do when you were an associate. You had to focus on the things they told you to, right? And so like, this is a really powerful and like very seductive thing to me about this whole idea of returning to a firm on the back third. Like, I 2 years ago when we started this podcast, nobody would have thought I'd say this today. But never. Like, it's just in the 2 years that I've watched some people make this change, that I've watched some people be really successful at making this transition. It's just more interesting to me than it ever was. I think there's a lot that there's a lot to be offered there. And what's great about it is it does something that in-house can't do. You're 53. You said it. I'm not you. You said it. So we're going to operate with that knowledge.
Almost. You get to work almost in a month. In a month.
A young 53. But you get to now surround yourself with young, brilliant sponges that you can teach. How cool is that? You can't do that in-house. If I went to my bosses and said, I want to hire 20 fresh out of law school types that I want to teach, they tell me I'm crazy, you know? But that's what your law firm does every summer, right? But, or whatever,
Pedro,
whatever the number
that's
is, right?
All true.
This is really
that's
cool.
That's all true. But if I see you in 10 years at the IAPP conference and you're wearing a suit, I am
that's
going to explode.
let's put a limit on things right now.
There has to be a limit.
We'll see where my career takes me, but I can tell you where it's not taking me. It's the funeral attire. It's not gonna happen.
All right, well, we have to wrap. That was a great conversation. I was like, thank you so much for joining us. We covered 1/8 of what we wrote down, but it was a great conversation.
But it was so good.
You so much for being with us. And what a great one to kick the new year off with. So appreciate it.
Yeah, I love it.
Thank you guys. Really, this has been so much fun. And, you know, I hope we can keep the conversation going offline,
love to.
As well.
Love to.
For sure.